Get your patience while I got all set up here. And today, you're probably going to say, finally, yeah, we're going to end our five-part series that was designed to help us all better understand the world of the Bible. We began at the beginning, and let's turn this on first, if that helps. And we found, of course, that the Bible was concerned with the ancient Near East. It's not necessarily concerned about the rest of the world. We learned that the Bible presents a God named Yahweh who's not needy, doesn't have human-like faults, doesn't have the negative characteristics that humans have. And we also saw that the Bible assumes the presence of behind-the-scenes gods, really, the activities of a spirit world, both for good and bad, that it actually acknowledges are gods. We would know them as demons today. And we commented, and I brought this up every single time, and I'll do it again today, that there's no secular world. The gods are involved in every aspect of life, and in fact, they were a large part of your very identity, of who you were. Excuse me. And I got to get rid of something here. There we go. I'm not getting... pardon me while I do something. I apologize for needing to do this, but... What happens? End up with two windows open, and that's not what I want. There we go. Now I can see the next slide. I apologize for that. Then we got to talk about the children of Israel and how they ended up, the people ended up in Egypt. And the family of Abraham was only one of many families that were making that journey, going toward the Nile River, where there was stability. And they weren't alone in becoming slaves. There was a mixed multitude down there. Other people were slaves, and other people left with them when they left Egypt. And upon being freed from slavery, they were bound at first by a covenant. They went to Sinai. They had this covenant. So they had a family bond, most of them, but not all of them, because there were others mixed in with them. They had a family bond. They had this covenantal bond as well. But they didn't have a central authority. They didn't have a king or any kind of a leader. And when they got to the land, they both conquered. They had some battles at first. And then later on, it was more of an assimilation. They just kind of moved in and spread over the land. There were parts of the land that didn't become part of Israel or conquered or subject to the Israelites until the reign of David. And the people eventually wanted to have a king, just like their neighbors. And the Bible, interestingly enough, and I think kind of amazingly, preserves the good and the bad of kings. And that's unusual for any kind of literature from the past that tends to minimize or eliminate the record of the problems that they had with their leaders, because the leaders wrote the history, right? But in Israel, we get to read the good and the bad of the leaders, which is interesting. And I think says something for the veracity of the scriptures. After Solomon's reign, the people split into two kingdoms. We know that there was Israel to the north, which was 10 tribes, and then Judah and Benjamin to the south. Israel was the more powerful of the two nations. Judah had less people, less territory, but they had this Davidic dynasty. Each king was the son of the king before. That wasn't the case in in Israel. Sometimes it was, but most often it wasn't. And they also, in Judah, had an attachment to the land. And that's very important in Jewish history and still today. All the while, Assyria, this nation to the north, was gaining in power. The prophets were warning Israel and Judah that their time was up in a way. They needed to repent or they were going to be taken over by the Assyrians. And that's what happened to Israel, of course. And then we talked about the exile, when the children of Israel were taken to other lands. We see here in this particular map that you have the northern nation of Israel that was dispersed in Assyria to the north. By the time the Jews were taken into captivity, 100 years later, it wasn't all the Jews, but they took them. By then it was the Babylonian Empire, not the Assyrian Empire, and they were taken to the area of Babylon. And this is probably the best and the brightest. What the leaders of these countries did is they would take the smart people, and they, for two reasons. One is they wanted the smart people to work for them at their head, at their capital. And two, if you take the smart people out of the country, then perhaps there's less resistance in that land to your rule. So there's two reasons why they would do that, and they did it a lot. Then the Israelites, of course, were conquered by the Assyrians. They were ruthless. They were mean people. The Babylonians less so, but, you know, they're still in control. And then eventually the Babylonians were conquered by the Persians that are from further to the east. And the Persian Empire was a huge empire. And under the Persians, the offer was made for the Jews to be able to go back home and build Jerusalem, rebuild Jerusalem, and rebuild the temple. So at this point, you have the beginning of what we call the diaspora. You have some Jews that are in Babylon. They didn't all come back. Only some of them came back. So you have a large Jewish community in Babylon. You have a large Jewish community, obviously, in Jerusalem. And the Bible doesn't care so much about this community now because it's focused back on Jerusalem. So what we have is the Bible dealing with this area. And only tangentially once in a while that are people from Babylon. We just, you know, what Jim was just reading there from Acts 2. There were people there at the services for Pentecost in the temple. And they were from all over the place. And it mentions Mesopotamia. So some of them were coming from Babylon because there were Jews there, obviously. And a lot of Jews from Asia and further west as well. So the Bible's going to focus here on this area where we've been all along. And then in the fourth installment of this, I talked about the Greek-speaking world, the spread of Greek culture, beginning with Alexander the Great, who was only lived for about 33 years, who was a great general, and created one of the largest empires in the ancient world before he was even 30. Never lost a battle. I just can't get over that. An amazing leader, an amazing military genius, maybe with some supernatural help. Some of the stories that you read about him, you just wonder, how can that be possible? So maybe he has some help. I don't know. He was tutored by Aristotle, as I mentioned, in medicine, philosophy, morals, religion, logic, all types of things, and art. And this led to a desire in Alexander and others that followed him to spread that culture to distant lands. And you think, well, that sounds reasonable. You'd want to spread culture, make people smarter. But one of the reasons that Alexander or anybody else wanted to do it wasn't just because it's a nice thing to educate all the people in the world, but because if you get people on the same page thinking what you think, it helps to unify your empire. So sometimes you can't get that through religion, sometimes you can, but you can get it through culture. And the Greeks did it through culture, and the Greek culture spread around the world, not by force, mostly by invitation. People liked it. The word for this spread of this culture is called Hellenization. It's from the Greek word that means Greek, Helen. And Alexander died at age 33. He didn't have any obvious heirs, so his kingdom was divided among his generals who began fighting over it, and they fought over it for hundreds of years. And this is a map that shows a little bit about what these empires were like. You had one down here in Egypt, the Ptolemies. You had the Seleucids here. You had other ones up here in Greece, which was the homeland, and also to the north. Once again, the area of Israel is in between two empires. Okay, now it's not Egypt, it's not the original Egyptians, we have the Ptolemies there now, but they're still in between. And sometimes they're going to be under control of the Ptolemies, sometimes they're going to be under the control of the Seleucids, sometimes they're going to be kind of left alone because one, they're paying the taxes in one direction, the other people leave them alone, or vice versa. They get a free pass sometimes just because of where they are. They're in the middle. The Ptolemies controlled them in the 3rd century B.C., in the 200s, but partly because they were just a buffer. They were a buffer there. So they were given a lot of latitude. Many Jews went to Alexandria, and that's another place. Acts 2, I don't think, mentions Alexandria by name, but it mentions Cyrene, which is nearby. So the Jews were beginning at this time to spread to other parts of the world. Times were sometimes rough here. So you had a large community in Babylon. You had a large community in Jerusalem. And you had a large community in Alexandria as well. And finally, they end up, and because of the large community in Alexandria, I don't have this in any of the presentations anywhere, there was a lot of traffic between here and Rome. Because strangely enough, this is a desert now, but it was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire back then, and there were a lot of ships going this way. In fact, Paul's free trip to Rome was on a boat that had went up, which way did it go? I forget how it went, but on its way to Rome, Paul caught it. It was a grain ship. So there was a lot of traffic, and Jews ended up migrating to Rome as well, mostly, or a lot of them from Alexandria. So you have a lot of different Jewish communities around the world now, and those are four of the big ones that I just mentioned. In the second century, you get to the 100s. This area is under the control of these guys, the Seleucids, the Antiochuses. All right, we talked about them, and under the Seleucids, the Hellenization was voluntary. To a large extent, there were Greek institutions, schools, gyms, all this kind of stuff that were established in Palestine. The upper crust sent their children to Greek schools to learn Greek language, Greek culture, Greek customs. They would take Greek names. They welcomed Antiochus Epiphanes when he came there the first time. I don't think I've got this in here, they had like uncircumcision operations and things like that. It's hard to imagine. It's bad enough the other way, but they were trying to become more Greek, less Jewish, I guess. Epiphanes, though, this one Antiochus, his name Epiphanes means God manifest. He was very driven to unify his empire by spreading the Greek culture. And he was willing to use force if necessary. Now, the Jews welcomed him at first, but he appointed high priests, depending on who was the highest bidder, who would give him the most money. He rewarded those who were friends of his policies, and he killed the ones that weren't. But he also did some other things. He outlawed circumcision eventually, and the Sabbath. He destroyed the scrolls. He ordered people to eat pigs. He was forcing Hellenization on the Jews that didn't want to participate. And that's the story we hear about. A lot of times you don't hear about that they welcomed him in the first place, but eventually he was the evil, you know, in their eyes. He set up an idol in the temple, sacrificed pigs. It was all awful. He appointed non-Zadok high priests based on bribes, as I said. And finally, there was a rebellion. We covered that before. We have the Maccabees. This is beginning again in the middle of the second century. One Jewish family that led a revolt against the Seleucid rulers. It took the form of a guerrilla war. They didn't have the numbers to stand up. But the leadership of this rebellion passed from father to son to other brothers, and one of the brothers took the name of Maccabeus, which means hammer, and eventually they won independence, not because they were such a wonderful fighting force, but largely because of infighting in the Seleucid Empire and fighting with the Parthians further to the east. So there were times when the Seleucids couldn't be bothered with the Jews and. In the eventual outcome was that they won their independence for a short period of time, better part of a century actually, almost. Part of it was due to we got a couple things going on. This is interesting. I just want to point it out. Partly due to an alliance with the Ptolemies in Egypt. That's what they would do. They make a deal with this group up here, and then this group here would be, you know, on the outside. So they made a group. They made a deal with the Ptolemies, and then they secured their independence from the Seleucids. They play one off against the other. And a lot of times, too, it involved an internal struggle in the Seleucid Empire where there was a struggle for who was going to be in charge there. This comes back to bite them later in the sense of what goes around comes around. Because you have the rededication of the temple. That's what where Hanukkah comes from, the Feast of Dedication that you read about in John 10. So the temple was cleansed, the sacrifices were restarted, had to be cleansed after the pigs there and all that kind of stuff, the statue of Zeus supposed to have been. So the temple was cleansed, sacrifice started in 165, and that's the origin of Hanukkah. They are somewhat, you know, semi-autonomous, but finally independent for, what is it, about 80 years or so. And then Pompey conquers Jerusalem in 63. Why was Pompey there? Now, you have to remember at this time, and I didn't go into it in a lot of detail, but Pompey and Julius Caesar were rivals. They were who was going to be, you know, get the approval of the Senate to be in charge. So you had a little bit of that going on. You had Caesar and you had Pompey. And you always have people trying to work both angles, you know. You know, who's going to you appeal to this guy and then this guy? So they were appealing to Ptolemy all along, and then you had in the these Hasmoneans. These are the people that are descended from the Maccabees. You had this rivalry going on between brothers who wanted to be in charge. Oh, sounds familiar. Just, you know, in the last century before that, they were using that kind of an opportunity to get their own independence. Now they got their own problem. They're going to fight among themselves for who's the leader, and they invite Ptolemy in. Ptolemy was invited. Now, at first, he supported one brother, just based on what he was hearing and the emissaries or the letters that went to him. And then later on, he hears the other side of the story, and he says, I better go check this out for myself. And when he goes and checks it out, he just conquers them. Because he realizes they're just fighting among themselves. They're no good for anybody. And he wants to put a feather in his cap because he's fighting against Julius Caesar to be the ultimate leader of the Roman Republic at that time. So here you go. The same people who before were trying to get the Seleucids to kind of fighting each other and the Seleucids to fighting the Ptolemies. Now they're fighting among themselves. And an outsider comes in, Pompey, and conquers Jerusalem. And effectively puts an end to their independence, although they still have a lot of leeway. Judea became a client state, so they had some freedoms, as I said, but because they had an alliance with Parthia, so you still have the Parthians further to the east, and you had Roman civil wars. You had Pompey and Caesar who were preoccupied with one another and weren't so totally interested in totally controlling the area around Jerusalem, but as long as they had marginal control of it, and they weren't causing any problem. And eventually you have Mark, after Julius Caesar, you have Mark Antony and Octavian, or Augustus, and there was less freedom then under those two, who were also at odds with one another. And then finally you have Herod, who was a client king. He was a king, but he's underneath the Romans, and there was even less freedom under Herod. So that gets us to the New Testament times, which I want to talk about today. And I got two or three different areas I want to cover here. I'm going to start with Herod. I know Jim talked about Herod several years ago, but you can't talk about this period of time without talking about Herod, so I'm going to talk about him again. He was a. I don't know, how would you describe him, Jim? He was a...
Ferocious.
A what?
Ferocious.
He was ferocious, yeah. He was a character. He was a piece of work. That's what they say, piece of work. I don't know what that means, but... All right, he was Idumean. What does that mean? That's you have the area of where Judea is, or around Jerusalem, and then to the south of that you have Edom, right? Edom coming from Esau. Well, he was from Esau. He wasn't a Jew, although he was raised a Jew. And this is interesting too, to talk about what goes around comes around. The Hasmoneans, under some guy named Hyrcanus, and there were several different Hyrcanuses, conquered the area of Idumea and forced everybody to convert to Judaism. Okay? So then when they get, you know, again, when they got Antiochus coming and forcing everybody to unconvert, you know, in a sense, it's just like what goes around comes around. Well, now you forced them to convert, and now one of their guys, Herod, whose mother was Jewish, I think, or somebody was, I'm not going to say, I forget the details, but he wasn't really Jewish. He was from this area that was forced to convert. He was Idumean. He was an Edomite. He was an Esau. He was from the brother, right? All right. I got Hyrcanus up there. Okay. This guy, Herod, he's one of these guys that always came out smelling okay, no matter what. He backed Mark Antony. That turned out to be the wrong choice because Octavian won that battle. All right, and Octavian became, you know, the heir. I always bring this up. You know, Julius Caesar had kids, but they weren't going to be Caesar. Caesar is the one he adopted. Adoption in this world, in this ancient world, that meant more than being a blood son or daughter to be adopted. So Octavian was adopted by Julius Caesar, and he became Augustus Caesar, the first emperor of the Roman Empire. Okay, but Herod had supported Mark Antony. Now what do you do? Well, if you're Herod, you travel to Rome. That's what everybody does. They always travel to Rome. I'm sorry, but you think I was loyal to Julius Caesar. You ought to wait and see how loyal I can be to you. And, you know, Octavian doesn't care. He trusts him enough. He knows he can crush him if he needs to. And he sends him back, and he becomes king of the Jews. Ruthless. He executed, I'm going to tell you, he executed many members of his own family. He married a Hasmonean princess. All right, the Hasmoneans are these descendants of the Maccabees that became the rulers. So he's an Edomite, right? He's from Idumea. He wants to make it look good. So he marries one of the princesses from the Hasmonean dynasty, named Mariamne, I think her name is. Later on, he has her killed. That's what Herod does. We've mentioned before, or I've mentioned, and Jim probably did it, that Augustus said it's safer to be Herod's pig than his son. He executed his sons. He executed his wives. It didn't really matter. He had many sons and daughters. He had about 8 to 10 wives altogether, depending on who you count as a wife. And he killed the relatives that he thought were threats. His rule ended, officially, the Hasmonean dynasty that we talked about, at 37 AD. He becomes client king under the Romans. One of the things he did, or not, there's many things he did, but one of his strengths, if you want to say he had some strengths, he wasn't all bad, was the man was a builder. And at times, the Romans gave him a break from taxation. Of course, the people always complained that Herod's taxes were too high, and all the Herod's taxes were too high. But he didn't have to pay, for some reason, I don't know what the deal was, he didn't have to pay taxes to Rome. At least a lot of times he didn't. And so to win favor, he would do things like, wouldn't there be a year when the Olympics needed an extra, infusion of cash? It's just like today. And so the Jewish state would support the Olympics. Well, that would win you points there in Rome. He would do other things. He'd build buildings to pagan gods, too. But one of the things he did was he built the Temple Mount. And you probably understand this, but all right, he increased the size of the temple grounds, but it was on a hilltop, so it's not flat. So what he did is he built all these walls, some of which are still around today, the Wailing Wall and all that. These walls, he built walls, filled it full of dirt, so he had a large level place to build his or to expand the temple. He couldn't rebuild it. He couldn't tear down the temple that was there. He did this construction while it was all being used. And then he could have all these extra areas in here, areas like Solomon's porch and all this that you read about in the New Testament. Love him or hate him, he was a builder. He built cities, he built fortresses, but he rebuilt the temple and built the Temple Mount. And of course, the people liked that. And he provided jobs for everybody. He built entire cities. There was big. Gary Stoshek talked about Sapporo. He came here and talked about Sapporo, the building projects there. Probably where a good chance that's where Jesus' father worked, because it was nearby to Nazareth. But he also built pagan temples. He didn't care. He was trying to win favor with everybody. He tried to be a good Jew to a certain extent to please the people. All right, that's Herod the Great. He's known as Herod the Great. In the Bible, we have now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king. This is the Herod. Magi from the east, these people came from the east to Parthia over there somewhere to Jerusalem saying, where is he? And Herod the king heard this and he was troubled. Why was Herod troubled? Because Herod's always troubled by anything he perceives as a threat. And what does he do when he perceives a threat? He kills somebody. All right? And the Bible tells us that I don't think I have the quote here, but what did he do? He killed all the babies in Bethlehem under 2 years old. So he tells them, go and search carefully for the child. After they talked to the religious people, said, where's the child supposed to be born? And they looked at scripture in Micah or wherever it is. It says it's supposed to be Jerusalem. It's supposed to be Bethlehem. I'm sorry. So go to Bethlehem, search for him. When you find, let me know so I can come and worship him. Yeah, sure. So I can come and kill him. And when they'd gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, said, get up, take the child and his mother, flee to Egypt, because he's going to search for the child to destroy him. And Joseph probably didn't need to be told that. Everybody knew any threat to Herod was going to be killed. So they remained in Egypt until the death of Herod. You can read that in Matthew chapter 2. Anything else I want to say? Oh, now the historians generally date the Herod's death to about 4 B.C., but you read of Herod's in the Bible after that, so we'll have to clear that up just a little bit. Herod's will, when he died in 4 B.C., appointed some of his sons to succeed him, and the Romans did allow three of them to do it. But this was all under Roman authority. Everything had to be approved. When Herod wanted to kill Mariamne, you got to get approval. You got to get approval for all this stuff, because he's a king, but not really. All right, so he has to go to Rome or send somebody to Rome to get approval for all these moves. So he turns his territory over to some of his sons. We got a son that has this area. That's Archelaus. We have a son that has the purple here and here. That's Herod Antipas. So we have Herod Philip, which has this area here. We have Salome. There's two different Salomes. I'm not sure which one this is. She gets some cities. This is a Roman province, has a governor up here. And then there's some cities that kind of have a certain amount of freedom in the Decapolis, the 10 cities here. You read about them sometimes. Jesus would go over to the other side of the Galilee, the sea, and interact with the people there. But most Jews wouldn't do that. Jesus did. Now, this seems complicated, but trust me, it gets worse. It gets worse. I could have gotten you a great big family tree of Herod. Did you do a family tree when you thought, oh, the guy, because he had like 8 or 10 wives, so you end up with a pretty big family tree when you do that, right? So you got Doris, we got Mariamne, we got Malthus, or however you say that, Malthace or something. We have Cleopatra, not Cleopatra of Egypt, although she's involved, but Cleopatra of Jerusalem. And then we have another Mariamne. So these are just the 6 or 5 that matter for what I want to cover, but there were others. The first wife, all right, Doris, has this son, Antipater. He's the first heir. And Herod makes him an heir, but then Herod feels threatened. What does Herod do when he feels threatened? All right, we got one down. That was 4 BC. Actually, there's some that happened before that, but he's out, all right? Then we go to the second wife, Mariamne. And she has 2 sons by Herod, Alexander and Aristobulus. Now, Mariamne is the Hasmonean princess, right? So he married her to kind of make himself look legit. But because of that, he's always feeling threatened by anything that has to do with her or her kids, because he thinks that the Hasmonean dynasty wants to reestablish itself. And so what does he do when he feels threatened? There's 2. I got 2 more going. So his wills are, he's paying the lawyers, I guess, or, you know, to change the wills all the time. He's got 3 of them, or 3 down. And all these executions require Augustus' approval. So now you see why he knew it was safer to be his pig. Because, you know, here comes somebody else asking if somebody, you know, here comes, Herod sent somebody else, seeing if we can kill this person or kill that person. Sometimes the people were sent to Rome, asked the Romans to kill them there. Mean guy. All right, so now we got 3 down. Now we got 2 other, we got this other, this, I don't know how to say her name, I'm sorry, Malthace or something. She's from Samaria, that's the area between Galilee and Judea. And she has 2 sons. One is called Herod Antipas, one's called Archelaus. And then there's a Cleopatra of Jerusalem has this other son, Herod Philip II, or Herod the Tetrarch, mentioned in the Bible. And they divvy up the territory according to that map I just showed you. You have Archelaus that gets this area. I'm going to get the Bible. Hopefully I can read it up here. Matthew, in Matthew chapter 2. Maybe I'll get my glasses. So when you read the New Testament, you got all these references to Herods. But who are these Herods? Matthew chapter 2. Look at verse 13. I'm not going to read all these verses necessarily, but the angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, "Arise, take the young child and his mother, and flee into Egypt," okay? Because Herod's going to destroy him. All right, we already talked about that. Now if we go to verse 19, but when Herod was dead, okay, so Herod was dead. This is Herod the Great. Behold, angel of the Lord appeared to in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, "Arise, take the young child and his mother, and go in the land of Israel, for they are dead, which sought the young child's life." And he rose, and he took the young child and his mother, and came into the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus did reign in his father's stead. Okay, so Archelaus now has this territory, which includes Jerusalem, all right? in Bethlehem. He heard, so, you know, maybe Joseph figured that the apple didn't fall far from the tree, and he heard that Archelaus was there, and he was afraid to go there. And notwithstanding being warned by God in the dream, he turned aside into the parts of Galilee. So he went further north. He went up into the Galilee, which would be up here. And that's why Jesus was from Nazareth. You know, he was born in Bethlehem, but he was from Nazareth. He grew up in Nazareth. Because it says here that his father was afraid to live in Judea while Archelaus was going to be the ruler. Now, Archelaus had to go to Rome to have his rulership confirmed. All right, because once Herod died, he's got to get this will, right? Well, the Romans don't care about Herod's will one way or the other. They got to approve everything. So he goes to Augustus to get approval for being the king. But he was unpopular, and there was a bunch of other people that went to Rome as well to say, we don't like this guy. And in the end, he only lasted until about 9 years. In 6 AD, he was replaced by a governor. And, you know, by the time Jesus is on the scene and Jesus is preaching, Pilate is that governor. He wasn't the governor in 6 AD. And if you go to Luke 19, you'll see something interesting here. And Jesus told parables all the time, right? And you can think, well, he just made this stuff up because he's just making a point. It doesn't matter. He can just make it out of a whole cloth, all brand new. But in Luke chapter 19, there's a story here that kind of sounds like it might be based in history. He's talking about the kingdom of God. You know, he has to give a parable on the kingdom of God. And look what he says in verse 12, Luke 19, 12. He said, therefore, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. Well, guess what? Archelaus had done that in the memory of the people that Jesus was talking to. Now, Jesus is talking 15 years later, maybe, but, you know, they remembered this. And he called his 10 servants and gave them some money and told them to invest it until he comes back. Take care. But it says his citizens hated him and sent a message after him saying, we won't have this man to reign over us. Was he using an historical event that everybody knew about? Maybe. The people did not like Archelaus. They didn't like him. And they did send a delegation to try to get him approved. He was approved, but he didn't last long. And Rome replaced him with a governor. Okay, moving on. Then you've got the region of the Galilee here, all right, which it says is purple. It's the territory under Herod, Antipas. And he's a different one. He's a different son of this one, Malthrasi. So we got Herod of Antipas. And he lasted, his reign lasted until 39. So here you have somebody else. Now, I also have on this chart somebody named Herodias. It's a female. She's here, and she's here. Okay? She's the husband of this guy, Herod Philip I, most historians actually call him Herod II, but this particular chart doesn't. She's his husband. But they all took a trip to Rome. There were lots of trips to Rome, okay? So Herod Antipas and Herod II and maybe their wives, whatever, had to take a trip to Rome. And on that trip, this guy notices his sister-in-law and wants her. All right? Because he's half brother with this guy. And so then she shows up on this family tree in two places. All right? Matthew chapter 14. Matthew chapter 14, verse 1. It says, at that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard of the fame of Jesus. What? Tetrarch. Well, that's not Herod the Great. That's Herod. Tetrarch means ruler of a quarter, of a fourth of the land or something like that. So he's called a Tetrarch here. So this is this Herod. This is Herod Antipas. All right? And in his whole career, he seems to like wants to see Jesus and find out something about him. And he's responsible, if I can go back. This is the area where Jesus did most of his ministry, right? He did his ministry here and with occasional trips down to Jerusalem, right? John the Baptist's ministry was along the Jordan, right? So right here near the Dead Sea, down here, this is the area where John the Baptist was preaching. That's also in Herod Antipas' territory. So we have a double connection here. All right. So he's talking about John the Baptist in verse 2. For Herod had laid hold in verse 3 on John and bound him and put him in prison for Herodias' sake, his brother Philip's wife. Why? Well, verse 4 says, for John said to him, it's not lawful for you to have her. Oh, okay. So John the Baptist got involved, and he said, you know, you're related to her. You can't go taking away your brother's wife to be your wife. Not only that, he doesn't say it, but she's his niece, too. It doesn't say that John said that. Maybe he did. In any event, Herod decided to leave him alone, but it says, when his birthday came, the daughter of Herodias danced before them and pleased Herod, and he offered her many things. And, you know, the mother was behind it all. Herodias was behind it all. And her daughter, who's her daughter? Salome. According to Josephus, it was Salome who did the dancing and asked for John the Baptist's head on a platter. That's the mother that was behind it all. But now she's over here. I told you it gets confusing. All right. Is there anything else I want to cover here before I leave? Okay, that cost John the Baptist his life. If we go to Luke chapter 23, while we're here talking about this particular Herod, in Luke 23, now this is where Jesus is on trial, right? And Pilate hears that Jesus is, in his ministry was all up in Galilee. He says, oh, okay. So he sends Jesus to have to, because Herod was in town, Herod Antipas was in town, he sends him over to Herod to talk. He said, you need to talk to Herod. You're in his territory. That's where you're from. And that's all in Luke 23. Let's see which verse. Start in verse 31. Do I have that right? No, 13. I want 23, verse 1 to 11. Yeah, I'm sorry. But before that, while I'm in Luke, I want to go to Luke 13 first. I'm sorry. Got ahead of myself. Luke 13, verse 31. The same day, certain of the Pharisees came to him saying, this came to Jesus, and they warned him. He said, Herod's out to kill you. Verse 31. And then verse 32, Jesus says, go and tell that fox, I cast out demons, I do cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I shall be perfected. You know, he's saying, you know, calling Herod a fox. And this is Herod Antipas, who's the ruler of Galilee at the time. Then if we go to, and by the way, this is just an idea that's out there. The word for fox is feminine. And there's some people out there, at least one person out there, and I thought this was interesting, so I'll repeat it, who said, well, therefore, it's like a female fox. It could be vixen. And the Jesus point could have been, who's afraid of that guy? You know, he's like a female fox. Why should I be worried about him? In any event, whatever he was calling him, it wasn't complimentary. Luke 23, yeah. Verse 1, now he was led to Pilate. This is what I'm talking about. And Pilate said, are you king of the Jews? And then verse 5, he's getting accused. He said, he stirs the people, teaching throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee. Galilee, okay. We need to, I can get rid of this problem right away. I'll just send him off to Herod. Herod can worry about it. Because I don't see any problem with him. He's innocent. I don't want to be involved. So he sent him to Herod, but Herod sent him back. So it didn't get him anywhere, one way or the other. So I don't need to cover that anymore. But so that is the Herod that is at the time of Jesus, Jesus' death. And here's the family tree, and here's the, you know, who's dancing and whose mother is behind it and all this. It was a mess. It's just typical of the Herod family. All right. Let's leave politics for a little while and talk about something more interesting. Meals. Eating. Because I told you I want to put the New Testament in its place, not just historically, but, you know, culturally. So I want to cover just a couple of things. Let's talk about meals, because I don't know if any of you remember, and if you do remember, you probably didn't watch it. But when I was younger, I watched Saturday Night Live when I was in college, and they had these characters from some other planet that would do strange things, but they lived on Earth as trying to live as normal people. Coneheads, that's what they were. And their children were trying to be normal in, you know, Earth society. But when they would eat, they would say, well, let's consume vast quantities. I think that was the quote. I didn't look it up. Consume vast quantities. In other words, it was just a matter of getting calories. Need calories to stay alive. Let's consume vast quantities. And, you know, I've thought about that a lot, not just then, but since then. And in America, a lot of times what we do is we're just consuming vast quantities. We eat because we have to eat, and sometimes we eat on the run. I eat on the run a lot, and it's just a matter of getting the calories. In the ancient Near East, it wasn't like that at all. Mealtime was an important time, especially under certain circumstances. So I want to talk about that just a little bit. Mealtime, for the typical laboring person, if you were just a working stiff, working out in the fields, you probably didn't get any breakfast at all. You might be able to grab something, a handful of something, as you went out into the field. But no breakfast, you did a small lunch, and then the dinner was your big dinner. That was typical for a working person. For those of more means, the meals were production, though. This is more of a, you know, where you had servants and bigger meals, and the meals were a social occasion. And I don't know whether they had breakfast or not, but they had big dinners. They had big dinners. Here's just take three examples from the Bible of the way meals are viewed in the ancient Near East. Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain, called his kinsmen to the meal. All right, offer a sacrifice, and everybody's going to come over. You're going to share this meal together. You're going to invite all the people that matter. And they ate the meal and spent the night on the mountain. Now, in those days, pretty much you only ate meat when you sacrificed an animal, and you had to dedicate it to the gods. It was still kind of like that in Jesus' time. Even the pagans would do that. We'll get there in a minute. So it wasn't just you have a meal. It's an important occasion. You invited everybody in this particular one, but this is the way it was viewed. It doesn't mean they did this every time they had a meal, but meals had a more important meaning in that world than they do in ours today. We know it just from reading the instructions about keeping the holy days. In Deuteronomy, it says, you may spend the money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen, sheep, wine, or strong drink, whatever your heart desires, and eat it in the presence of the Lord your God and rejoice, you and your household. This is a meal done in God's presence. You're inviting God to be there. And that's what we're doing. We might not always think about that when we keep the holy days, but that's having a festive meal with God. That's what that's all about. And the Bible's written from that perspective, because that's the world that they thought about that. They didn't have just regular meals. You know, meals were had more import than they do now. Even you get to the New Testament in Revelation. I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come to him and dine with him and he with me. You know, the indicator or the proof that we have a relationship is that we'll eat together. So when you eat together and have, that's proof that you have fellowship, that you have connection, that you belong, all those things. Because there are certain expectations that come with a meal. Fellowship was implied, or, you know, if you're going to have a meal with somebody, it meant that you belong. And I gave that sermon probably several years ago here about Jesus being invited to the house of Simon the Pharisee, and how he was he didn't receive a kiss, he didn't receive the washing his feet and all that kind of stuff, where he was slighted on purpose probably. And that just wasn't acceptable, because because it was a big occasion and a meal, those things that Simon did, or you might say didn't do, to Jesus carried huge import. They were sending a signal, a very important signal. So meals, again, were very different at those times. I got my 7 G's. I just came up with this because here, what do you have? At a meal, you, at these social occasions, big meals, you had guests, you had a greeting. That greeting involved what? Kiss, wash the feet, maybe have some kind of ointment, which in this case, in Simon's case, that Mary ended up providing. So you have the official greeting. You have some grooming going on. You know, you're cleaned up a little bit. You gather. People come together. It's a gathering. And everybody talks, gabbing. All right, I just wanted it to be another G. They're all gabbing. And then you got food, which is, in G would be grub, right? And everybody has to act, no matter whether there's a slight or not, everybody has to be very gracious with one another. Best meal I've ever had, blah, you know, all that kind of stuff. And finally, there's gratitude. You're thankful. It's over. And this got this occasion. It's an occasion with meaning. It's not just having empty calories or good calories or whatever it is, or eating mass quantities. You're having a meal. It's an occasion. And you get extra credit if you know where that quote's from. There's the rub. There's the rub. Who knows? What dreams may come when I've shuffled off this mortal coil? I had to memorize this in high school. Must give us pause. Hamlet. It's from Hamlet's soliloquy. There's the rub. What's the rub? The rub is, there's a rub that we're going to talk about. It comes into the New Testament times when it comes to meals. There's a problem. What's the problem? Well, look at this. This is a map. I've showed you this before. We were talking about the city of Corinth. All right? And in this layout, this was from 100 AD, slightly after Bible times, but it would have been similar back in the time that Paul was there. Notice what we have here. We have two temples. We have the temple of Octavia. We have the temple of Apollo. What happens at temples? Sacrifices. That's where the meat comes from. Where do you sell the meat? Well, you sell it in the marketplace, the agora, right? Or stoa. Stoa would be the enclosed places in the agora. So here's the temple. Here's the temple. There's where the meat's sold. This is a reality of everyday life in Corinth and every other city in the Roman Empire, any city of any size. So Paul, when he's talking to the Corinthians, he has to deal with this because every day they have to deal with the reality that the meat that they get in the marketplace has been sacrificed either here or here, most likely. This is an issue because you have people coming into the church in Corinth. They were Gentiles. They used to worship Apollo or Octavia or whoever. And now they don't. They know where the meat comes from. So this is a problem in the church. What do we do about this? And Paul writes them. He says, concerning the eating of things sacrificed to idols, we know that there's no such thing as an idol. There's only one God. And even so-called gods in heaven or earth, there are many gods and many lords, but there's only one real God. All right, we talked about that before. The Father, for whom all things and we exist for him, and the Lord Jesus Christ, by whom are all things and we exist through him. However, not all men have this knowledge, but some, being accustomed to the idol until now, eat food as if it were sacrificed to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. So somebody's brand new to the understanding that Jesus is king and not Caesar. And they've been going all their lives there in Corinth to the marketplace to get the meat, and they know where that meat's being sacrificed, and they think to themselves, this meat's been sacrificed to an idol, I can't touch it. And Paul understands that. He says, you know, he says their conscience is weak because they don't really understand that the idol is nothing, but they really do feel this way. So what to do about it? Well, Paul concludes, he says, if food causes my brother to stumble, I won't eat meat again. So I won't cause my brother to stumble. In other words, don't toss it in their face. Oh, there's nothing wrong with this thing. Have a bratwurst, whatever. Or whatever. I don't know which wurst we can eat and which we can't. But don't do it. Don't do it if it's going to cause offense to the weak people, the weak, the new. In another place, he says, you know, you can't eat anything that's sold in the meat market without asking questions. You don't have to ask, was it just sacrificed to, and who was it sacrificed to, and, you know. If one of the unbelievers, if somebody that invites you over to eat, you don't have to ask them where the meat was sacrificed, or if it was sacrificed. Just eat. You don't have to ask. But if somebody says to you, ah, it's great meat, sacrificed to Apollo just this morning, praise Apollo, then you better not eat it, because you'd defile his conscience. You know it's nothing, but he doesn't. And if you ate it, that would give the wrong impression. So you see, it was a difficult thing. And we read it. We don't see the Corinthians' questions, but we read his answers. And yeah, it's kind of sticky. It's kind of a messy thing. Like I told you, there's no secular world. Everything involves the gods. And for the Gentiles, it was tricky. I'll mention a little bit more about that in a little bit. It was tricky for them for several reasons. In 1 Corinthians also, we read in chapter 11 that in some form or another, they were doing, what some people call the Lord's Supper. We call it a New Testament Passover. I think when you read the context, they weren't doing exactly what we do. Or they were, if they were doing exactly what we do, they were doing it in a larger context. They were doing other things as well. Because you read where, in 1 Corinthians 11, and Paul says, I don't praise you because you come not together for the better, but for the worse. In the first place, when you come together as a church, I hear there are divisions that exist among you, and in part I believe it, for there must be factions among you, so that those who are proved may become evident among you. Therefore, when you meet together, it's not to eat the Lord's Supper, for in your eating, each one takes his own supper first, and one's hungry and another drunk. So what's the problem? And it's kind of tricky because we don't know exactly what was going on. We're reading his answer without reading the question. But I want you to notice something. He's talking about divisions, and he's talking about factions. And he's also talking about how the meal was eaten in an unworthy manner, or how whatever they were doing, it was done in an unworthy manner. What? Don't you have houses in which to eat and drink, or do you despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you? And this I will not praise you. I didn't underline it, but I should have. You shame those who have nothing. So there were divisions. There were sects, you could say. There were factions. There were cliques, use the French word, in the church. Paul didn't like it, especially having to do with the symbols. All right, here's my opinion. This isn't an opinion, this is true. Class distinctions were a very important part of Roman society and how life was lived. Slavery in the Roman Empire didn't have anything to do with what race you were, who your mother was, or who your father was. Well, it could, if you were born to a slave, you were still a slave. But it was a class thing. The Romans had conquered your country and took you into slavery, or you were a debtor, or whatever reason. You are a slave, you're a different class. You're a different class. They weren't looked down on necessarily for, because your slave could be the one who taught your children. You know how picky we are about who our child care people are? Well, in the Roman world, it could be a slave who was very intelligent and educated. But they were slaves because they were a different class. The church comes along and abolishes the class consciousness, at least tries to. Others on the outside would look in at the church and say, it was odd because, you could have a slave woman who's a deaconess in the church or a slave who's a deacon in the church. And that would be unheard of on the outside. To have somebody, give somebody status in your organization who didn't have the class status in society. The church was different, or at least trying to be different. Paul is being critical of the Corinthians here because whatever it was that they were doing, it led to led to obvious class distinctions in this meal or this gathering. And some had a lot, and some didn't have anything. And he didn't like this. He said, this is a very, very ceremony that's supposed to picture that we're all one body. And in fact, this is the one ceremony that you guys have that proves that you're not one body, that you got all these differences, and you know, you've got a pecking order among yourselves. And some of you come together, and you get there early, and he tells them later, he says, when you come together, eat, wait for one another. If one's somebody's hungry, let them eat at home so that you will not come together for judgment. Some of the rich people were coming together, getting there early, having their own meal together. The poor people that didn't have any food, they came later, they didn't have anything. Paul said, this is unacceptable. We can't have these class distinctions in the church, especially at a ceremony that pictures us all being one body. I think that's what it's about. I don't know exactly what they were doing. Maybe the symbols were part of a larger meal. It seems to be how they were doing it at the time. Paul could not handle, or he didn't have any room in his theology for the fact that that you have this class distinction. So he said it was wrong. And you know what? It didn't go away just because Paul preached against it, because many years later, you can read in the book of James, where, my brethren, don't hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism. For if a man comes into your assembly with a gold ring and dressed in fine clothes, and there comes a poor man in dirty clothes, and you pay special attention to the one who's wearing the fine clothes and say, here, sit in a good place, sit up front. You say to the poor man, stand over there or sit down by my footstool. Haven't you made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil motives? But you have dishonored the poor man. It's been a problem. It's been a problem for 2,000 years. It's very hard for us not to show favoritism based on what class we perceive people to be in. And some societies are much worse than others, but it's part of any human society because that's just the way we are. Paul points out, on the other hand, and I got to go back here. You know, we can have a knee-jerk reaction to this. We can say, all right, because class distinction is not good, we can go to the other extreme and just abolish all norms of behavior and the way we dress and act and all this type of thing to prove that we're all the same. You know, we could all just, wear a toga and sandals because we're all going to be the same. And that'll prove that we're all the same. No. That's a wrong reaction. And Paul addresses that. I put it this way. Proper societal norms ought to be followed to avoid unnecessary criticism. You know, why invite criticism on yourself? It's not wise or necessary to oppose everything about society. And we can get that way. I tend to kind of be that way. It's like, that's the way I kind of was brought up. We were different enough being in a church, and then you can find yourself like opposed to everything. And Paul's saying, well, wait a minute now. You don't have to be that way. Don't take your brothers to court. All right? That's one thing he covers in chapter 6. Chapter 7, just because your wife or your husband decides he doesn't want to come to church with you doesn't mean you have to divorce him. All right? You can live, live in peace. Chapter 9, meet people where they are. He says, I become weak to those that are weak and those types of things. You don't have to pretend to be so entirely different from everybody that they can have nothing to do with you. You can meet them where they are. So apparently within the congregation there in Corinth, they had gone to extremes in some ways. And Paul's saying, we need to get back closer to the middle a little bit. 1 Corinthians 10, he talks about, he says, just because something's legal or lawful, it might not be edifying, or he uses another word I don't remember right now. But think, why do you do what you do? Just because you can do it, it might cause offense. So in the congregation, in the church, I think we do a good job with it here, and there are other places that I think we do, but you have people that that flaunt their, what they see is their freedom to be this or be that or be something else, and they put it right up in your face when you're not the same way. And Paul's saying, no, you don't have to do that. Yes, we're different when we have to obey certain things, but we don't have to be different for the sake of being different. Male and female distinctions, it talks about the head coverings or hair, however you look at it. The main point being, it's still okay to have these differences. We don't want people to walk into the assembly and see that you're everything's upside down. And they're going to think you're crazy. He says that in chapter 14. Use the spiritual gifts to serve one another, not to look like you've gone off the deep end. So our behavior doesn't have to be just opposed to everything that's societal. We don't want to participate in the bad parts of society, but some parts are just fine. You know, Paul's not making a point necessarily, I don't think, about head coverings one way or the other. It's just that's what was normal. What was normal, so let's not be different. Let's not be different in our congregations. As I pointed out to you before, the women always wore head coverings back then. And if you in the Jewish communities, if you uncovered your head, that was enough reason to divorce your wife, if your wife uncovered her head. I'm not suggesting that's the way it ought to be, but that's the way it was. And so Paul's saying, you don't have, just because you're in your private little, you know, place, that doesn't mean the women can all take off their head coverings or whatever. We can act differently and invite criticism of the congregation. Let's not do that. Okay, I want to talk about one other thing before we wrap up. Religio licita. That's a term that Tertullian invented, I believe. And it just means legal religion. Tertullian lived later, but this is the point. That Judaism in the Roman Empire had standing because it was an ancient religion. Julius Caesar started this. That he left the Jews alone. Julius Caesar was the de facto ruler, at least after Ptolemy, for when the Jews became part of the Roman Empire in 63 AD, and later on. But the Jews had an ancient religion, and they were allowed to practice that religion. So it was legit or legal. Julius Caesar had given them the right to do that. He didn't care about the Jews one way or the other. Just this thought to him is going to make the empire more stable, or the republic at his time, more stable. And he had an okay relationship with Herod, not because he loved the Jews in particular. Now, Augustus continued the policy that would be during the time of the early New Testament. The Jewish religion was not seen as a threat. The typical pagan prayers, all over, I said, you know, you wouldn't start a meeting without having some kind of prayer to some pagan god. It's all the time. It was pervasive. You had the paganism. Well, the Jews were exempt from that. They didn't have to participate. But what they would do and were expected to do is in their synagogue services, they would pray for the emperor or pray for the Senate or pray for whoever. And Paul tells us to pray for our leaders. So it's you know, we are to do that, although, you know, they weren't in their time to participate in the pagan prayers and so forth, but they had their own. On the other hand, Gentile Christians did not convert to Judaism. So I want to make a point here on this one of the last slides here, that when we read the New Testament, we have to understand the perspective of the Gentile converts. Gentile Christians did not convert to Judaism. Everybody agrees on that. We all disagree about the details. How much Jewish stuff did they do or not do? But they didn't become Jews. Christianity, then, did not enjoy this ancient allowed religion status. It was a new religion. It didn't become an accepted religion until the 3rd or 4th century. You know, it was a pretty different religion by then, in some ways. It didn't become the official religion until 380, I think it was. But in the time of the New Testament, it was a brand new thing. It was seen as a cult of Judaism. But it wasn't Judaism. And it didn't enjoy the same standing and protection. So you have Jewish Christians, and then you have Gentile Christians. But the Gentile Christians didn't have any standing. They didn't have this protection, you might say, from the government who said, it's okay, leave them alone. They can practice their religion. Because they weren't practicing Judaism. They weren't Jewish. They weren't circumcised. And this mattered. In that world, you had to have a network. You had to have, everybody's hooked to somebody. You had the patronage system where the rich and the people that had things made sure that those under them that supported them had whatever it was, food, land to grow food on, jobs, you know, some kind of security. It's a patronage system. And the Gentiles, by converting to Christianity, oftentimes lost whatever connections they had in their own pagan networks, and didn't gain a new Jewish network to replace it, so they're left out in the cold in a way. So I think we need to feel for them a little bit. And when we read the New Testament, we have to realize that they were persecuted from all sides, sometimes from the government, sometimes from Jews, and unfortunately, sometimes from Jewish Christians. We're supposed to be all in the same loaf here, right? all in the same body. But Paul was constantly being dogged by these Judaizers that said, no, these Gentiles have to become Jews. So, unfortunately, in the church, these Gentiles who had sometimes given up everything to say Jesus is king and not Caesar, lost it all. They'd given it all up, and it didn't get anything to replace it. I mean, they got, oh, I shouldn't say that. They got salvation. You know, they got that relationship with God. I'm talking about physically on earth in their communities. They lost networks. They lost patronage. They lost the things that they needed, and oftentimes there was nothing to replace it with. So as you read the New Testament, remember this, that the Gentiles were in a very precarious situation because of not being Jewish and leaving the security of being a normal, you know, Corinthian that did the Corinthian things that the Romans said, this is what you're supposed to do. The Jews could get away with not being that way because they were the Jews. Gentiles, they had to stop doing the pagan things, but they didn't have the Jewish, they weren't Jewish, so they didn't have the connection and protection that that provided. So we ought to appreciate that. So as we read the New Testament, remember that the world was dominated by the Romans, but there were local kings. There were these different Herods and sometimes semi-kings. They weren't really kings. They were tetrarchs. The Romans wouldn't call them kings. And governors. Sometimes you had a governor in Syria, you had a governor in Judea. And those people, those lesser leaders, had more of an impact on the day-to-day life of the people who lived there. It was a world where meals, especially among the upper classes, had special meaning and were important social occasions. They weren't just a chance to consume calories. It was a world saturated with class distinctions in a way that we don't really appreciate in America. And the church was not supportive of these class distinctions. Within the church, we were supposed to be different, not have these distinctions. And that was a constant battle. It was a world where connections and patronage were very important and where a Gentile converting to Christianity often lost both of them, and as well as governmental tolerance. They gave up everything. The Gentiles gave up everything to follow Christ and oftentimes did not get much physically in any way to replace that. So there you have it. We could have covered a lot more, but I hope that these five sessions have demonstrated to you the importance of context. You know, it pays to understand the world that the Bible was written in. And now I hope you have a deeper understanding for the Bible, a book that was written in another time, but for our time.